From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. President Bush wants to give people more choices about their future. He says more control will make us better off. Experts who study economics and human behavior say it depends. Few people act purely in their self-interest. Economists refer to this as being irrational. We break into a cold sweat over too many choices and then do nothing. We make bad bets. We overpay for things we don't really want. And we don't save for the things we really do. Tonight on Point, how Bush's vision for an ownership society could be undercut by the sometimes irrational choices we make. We begin in Washington for the latest on President Bush's campaign to fix Social Security. Aaron Bernstein is associate editor in the Washington Bureau for Business Week magazine and author of the January 24th cover story, Social Security, Are Private Accounts a Good Idea? I asked him for a snapshot of where we are now in the president's campaign.
The Bush administration has, of course, been out pushing their private account plan. The president's been doing it, and he's asked his colleagues in the Republican Party on the Hill to do that. And about maybe a third of the House, it looks like they're going to do it this week, go out and hold town hall meetings and try to convince constituents that this is a good idea. So far, they're having a pretty uphill battle. And there's been a lot of negative responses, although the polls haven't really changed. I mean, the bad news for the president is he hasn't changed anybody's mind yet, and a majority of Americans started out not liking the sort of general concept of private accounts. The good news is he hasn't actually lost ground despite all the negative, you know, publicity and negative media that he's gotten.
Well, clearly a lot of Democrats oppose this idea, but what about Republicans? Are all of the Republicans on board?
Oh, not at all. No, they're very nervous about this on a whole, for a whole number of reasons. Some of them don't like the idea of spending all the amount of money that it would cost to switch the current system over to one that would allow private accounts. It would cost a lot of money. $1 to $2 trillion is the estimate over 75 years. That makes a lot of Republicans nervous. You know, they don't like the big budget deficits that the federal government's already running, and they certainly don't like the idea of borrowing more money to fund private accounts if it would increase the deficit, which it probably would. Aside from that, Republicans are just nervous politically because middle-aged and older people don't like the idea, and young people, either some of them don't like it or a lot of them just aren't paying attention. But so the people who are complaining the loudest are the ones who don't like it, and Republican lawmakers, this is not something they want to fight about if they don't have to. So for a lot of reasons, even the president's own party is divided on this, which makes his battle all the harder. And now recently, you know, this week, Bush suggested that maybe there would be a tax increase to pay for some of this. And that hasn't gone over very well. The Democrats actually, of course, you know, they wouldn't mind that. A lot of Republicans don't like it at all. And several House leaders have spoken out saying, no, that's a bad idea.
Well, and also the AARP has taken out some full-page ads in the New York Times criticizing the Bush plan. No surprise there, perhaps. But how big a blow is something like that, a full-scale ad campaign?
Well, I think that we're just seeing the start of this. The AARP got in there early, and those ads have certainly set the tone, basically arguing that private accounts are risky. You're, you know, playing with dice when you put your money in the stock market, your retirement money. But the airwaves and newspapers are going to be full of this over the next few months. The business groups, the White House has been urging business groups to jump in here and counter those ads with their own ad campaigns on television and newspapers and on the radio. And several of the large business groups are gearing up to do that, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, the usual sort of big business groups. And, you know, collectively it looks like they're going to spend on their side some $100 million for a massive PR campaign and a lobbying campaign. So we're just getting started here. Some people may be sick of it already, but it's just starting. You're going to see a lot more ads on both sides.
I was going to ask, how do you account for people's hesitancy about this? Are they eager or reluctant or simply don't know what to make of it quite yet?
Well, the polls show that, you know, the polls are sort of contradictory on this subject. And it's a little bit hard to figure out, but basically it seems to be what's happening is that when you say, wouldn't you like to own your own Social Security account and have your own private account that you could pass on to your heirs and, you know, invest as you see fit? And everybody likes it when you say that. You know, a majority of Americans will go, that's a great idea, young people and old people. It's like, yeah, wow, I want that. You know, my own 401k, that's a good idea. Then you say, so would you like to have your own private Social Security account knowing that if the stock market crashes when you're nearing retirement that you could end up with a lot less than you would get under Social Security or maybe even nothing? All of a sudden, the same idea is really bad.
So the devil's in the details.
Start telling people how risky it is, then they don't like it. They like the idea of owning their own account, but not when they realize the downside is I'm going to retire on, you know, in poverty. Then people said that's not a good idea.
And so, what do you see as the next step for the president here?
Well, he's got to convince not just the politicians in Congress, but first the American public that that this is a good idea. You know, that the risk of investing your Social Security or part of your Social Security in the stock market is going to be outweighed by the returns that stocks typically give.
Aaron Bernstein, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Aaron Bernstein is associate editor in the Washington Bureau for Business Week magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. The ideals of an ownership society appeal to many Americans. We do want more control over our futures. But when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of Bush's plans, we're not quite as sure that we're ready to take the reins, or that that's what we had in mind when we thought about more control. Tonight on Point, an ownership society and the many difficult choices that come with it. You can join the conversation. What does an ownership society mean to you? Is it something we should strive for? Do you think the country would be better off? Do you think you would be better off? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is David Laibson, professor of economics at Harvard University. He has written extensively about saving for retirement. Hello, David.
Hi.
Also with us from New York is L.K. Weber, professor of psychology and management at Columbia University. She is co-editor of Risk, Decision, and Policy. Welcome to you, L.K.
Pleasure to be here.
And also in the studio with me is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Nice to see you as well as hear from you, Jack.
A pleasure to be here with you, Gail.
Okay, I want to start with you and ask, what is appealing to people about this concept of an ownership society? What are the ideals that it taps into? LK?
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize you were addressing me. I think one of the basic ideas that is very prevalent in American society is that agency, that being able to make your own choices, is a good thing. One thing we might want to examine is to what extent that is actually a general feeling or whether that's a feeling that's specific to particular groups or subgroups in the country. There's actually extensive cultural and cross-cultural research on that. And the notion that sort of more choice is good, that the ability to make decisions on your own for yourself is a good thing, actually seems to be a relatively Western concept. So if you look at cultures like Japan or China, there's actually evidence that in those cultures where collective decision-making is more valued, where autonomy, personal autonomy is less valued, people oftentimes are more satisfied with the outcomes of societal or personal decisions if they didn't make the decision on their own, if some respected superior made it for them.
David Laibson, from an economics point of view, how might this be a positive force for change? Or does it take us from the we're all in this together mentality into more of a me first mentality?
This is the classic economics on the one hand, on the other hand problem. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
I figured you'd be comfortable with
that.
Yeah.
So, sure, who knows better than you what's in your best interest? Who knows better than you how much you should save? Who knows better than you what your particular financial situation is? What your children are going through right now, what your hospital bills were last night. And the economist says, the traditional economist says, you know your situation, you know your needs, you know your abilities. You should make your own choices. On the other hand, we're not always experts particularly when it comes to financial decision-making. So we're not always experts about stocks, about bonds. What's a mutual fund? What's a 401k? How much should I save for retirement at age 27? Not that I'm that age. How much should I save when I'm 43? And what about my asset allocation? So economists struggle with these questions. In many ways, we are best situated to make our own choices. On the other hand, there are experts. There are financial planners. There are advisors. There are governments. There are firms. They may know something that can help us.
And Jack Beatty, I wonder if ownership society is really the right term. Is there another way of looking at this?
Well, you know, the president is wont to say, to use an analogy, he says, ownership is a good thing. Welcome to my home, he says. You know, and so on the basis of that, we think of the home and we think of the economic motivation that goes with that. We improve our home. We have a stake in our communities. Everyone recognizes that. And then the analogy is to, well, now you own your own account. It's like, welcome to my money. And it's a much more abstract kind of property that does not have attached to it the motivating power that every economist from Adam Smith recognizes in the real property kind of ownership, where you improve it. You're not going to be there watering your investments, maybe.
Much more to talk about. We have to take a break, and then we'll be back. We're talking this hour about President Bush's vision for an ownership society and the sometimes irrational decisions that people make. Are you excited about this idea? Does having more control and more choice make sense to you, or is it a little scary? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about an ownership society, about saving in America, and what people might do if they had more choices. You can join the conversation. Do you think Bush has it right? Does more choice make sense to you? Or do you not really trust yourself to make cold, hard decisions about your economic future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with David Labson, professor of economics at Harvard University, L.K. Weber, professor of psychology and management at Columbia University, and our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. David, I want to get back to one of those basic precepts of economics, in addition to on the one hand, on the other hand, and that is the notion that people behave rationally. But is that really true when it comes to your own money, or are most of us fairly quirky, both in our attitudes and our behavior?
Most of the time, people make very, very good decisions. And economic theory, as you suggested, is based on that precept. People, by and large, get things right. The question is, do we get everything right? And there the answer is probably no. So there are important areas of our decisions that we systematically get wrong, or at least a lot of people get wrong. I'll give you an example. In 401k accounts, it's often the case that your contribution gets matched by your employer. That's free money. You put a dollar in, your employer will match you a dollar. You have $2. It's hard to argue that people would give up that opportunity, particularly if you're over age 59 and a half. For people over that age, there's no penalty for withdrawing the money. They can put a dollar in, get a dollar match, and take it out the next day with no penalty. So there's no liquidity loss. And yet, 40% of savers, 40% of employees, don't take advantage of that employer match, even the employees over age 59 and a half.
That would certainly sound a little irrational. So, L.K., let me put the question to you. Why do you think people don't participate in 401ks, or why do they in general put off saving for retirement? Is it because today grabs so much more of our attention than tomorrow?
I think that is one very important reason. Also, I think it's, you know, sort of not particularly pleasant to think about your old age, to think about the fact that you might not have enough money to support the lifestyle you currently are accustomed to. And I think also there are probably evolutionary reasons for that. Worrying about sort of your financial future in 50 years' time is probably not something that we were prepared to worry about 5 to 20,000 years ago in the Serengeti, when these emotions that drive our risk protection behaviors evolved. We were really hardwired to worry about where our next meal is going to come from, make sure that nobody kills us within the next 20 minutes or so. And I think it's those kinds of risks that worry us that we do something about. Pension investments don't worry us. In fact, I was at a conference a year or so ago that involved 150 researchers and industry experts that were dedicating their research to pension investment. I asked them how many of them actually sort of sat down at least once a year to review their pension investment portfolio. Three or four raised their hand. It's not something we worry about, therefore we don't do anything about it. And I think one of my concerns is that with choice comes responsibility. If something is not very high on our radar screen because we don't have that affective reaction, that worry about it, we're not going to pay adequate attention to it.
Well, and David Leibson, I wonder if also with too many choices comes just confusion, overwhelmment. You know, I can't begin to sort this stuff out, so I'm just not even going to think about it.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that a series of research studies have shown that giving people too many choices tends to make them withdraw and not actually go ahead and buy a product or not go ahead and join a 401k plan. So too many choices can be overwhelming. Now, that said, there are ways to constrain choices. So employers or the government can pick a small set of options in the privatized Social Security system. So I don't think that necessarily privatization means overwhelming choice.
Well, how much of a role should the government play here? I mean, you know, firstly, how economically sophisticated do you have to be as an individual to invest your money wisely? And how can the government play a positive role in limiting those choices?
So there are some people who are, let's say, libertarians and say the government should play no role in limiting our choices. There are others who say people are overwhelmed by too many choices and it's our job to give them a very small set, a reasonable set, and let them choose among those reasonable options. I take the view that particularly when it comes to investment choices, giving people a limited set of reasonable options is the right way to go. We should exclude, say, a gold fund from a privatized system. We should exclude funds that have enormously high management fees. We should give people reasonable assets to choose among. And I think if we did go down this road, that would be a sensible approach.
Okay, Weber, how might people who don't know very much about the stock market be likely to respond to this notion that, okay, this is the way you have to go. You have to invest in the market if you want to have money for retirement.
Well, I think people will look for simplifications. There's a fair amount of research that people will use whatever rule of thumb that's available to them. Obviously, too much choice paralyzes you, and some action is better than no action. There are, on the other hand, sort of insights about what people do that can actually help us design systems that work, that turn our perhaps irrational reactions to our advantage, in some sense, sort of some reverse psychological judo where we turn biases towards people's advantage. Let me give you a simple example, which has to do with the fact that we discount future consequences very much. And we oftentimes put off pension investments to tomorrow, to a year's time, to 10 years' time, because we don't want to take that money out of circulation for immediate consumption. Turns out that behavioral economists actually have designed savings plans, pension savings plans, that capitalize on that. So you can actually get people to buy into a decision to invest future earnings towards their pension savings because that loss hurts less than it would hurt if the current income was taken out of circulation.
Jack Beatty, what do you think about this? Are people able to be that dispassionate, that logical, when you're talking about something as profound as your money and your future?
In a word, no. I mean, Las Vegas exists on the opposite proposition. Those casinos would not be so munificent. Those edifices would not rise so high. Those entertainers would not be paid so lavishly if people didn't lose and lose regularly on their bets. And, that's part of this, too. Capitalism is fine. Making a product, starting a business, performing a service. This is something else. This is the casino. This is the bet. And it's not the most noble part of capitalism because, of course, it leads to unearned money, right? My money made money. I didn't make the money. And for a long time, there was that great prejudice against it for that reason. And secondly, it isolates people. It's wealth. People think of their wealth, their property, whereas so many of our problems are problems of commonwealth. The air, for example, the environmental crisis, our situation in globalization and what that means for education and so on. All of these things are common problems. Those are our big areas of problem. And this business of thinking of you know, thinking about myself, well, you know, that's fine to have your wealth, but it won't do you a darn bit of good if you can't breathe the air. And you can't, and if we keep living the way we're going, that's going to be tough.
Let's go to our phone lines now from Kingston, North Carolina. Kirk is on the line. Hi, Kirk, and welcome.
Yes, good evening.
Go ahead.
Yes, well, I just want to say I'm absolutely totally in support of a ownership society because basically we have always endured the fact that property is such a valuable thing, and a lot of people don't realize our labor is our property and the profits we make from our labor is our property, and yet 50% of our property is consumed in the cost of government. You know, you take your income tax, your FICA, your Medicare, and all the other hidden costs of government, it's 50% of my wages. So it's absolutely a fantastic idea that goes back to individuals owning their own property.
Kirk, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Suffern, New York now and hear from Joe. Joe's on the line. Hello, and welcome to you, Joe.
Hello. The point I'd like to make is that by phrasing this argument in terms of the choice it provides, we miss the fact that what the government is trying to do is replace government responsibility for taking care of those who would otherwise be destitute in old age with personal responsibility. That is, if you save, you might do better, but if you don't, your benefits will be reduced. Before Social Security, there was great poverty among the retirees, and that's why Social Security was founded. I believe that the government is actually trying to shirk its obligation to do what this program does, which is redistribute some wealth and force people to save for their retirement. I think that program has a purpose and is a good thing. How the government of a supposedly compassionate conservative can ignore the impact that this will probably have of causing, you know, basically more poverty as those least able to help themselves feel the punishment of personal responsibility is completely beyond me.
Got it, Joe, and we thank you for the call. What about those two points of view, David Labson?
Let me just clarify some of the issues that are on the table. The proposal is not to eliminate forced savings. The proposal is to take some of that forced savings and put it into these private accounts. Now, I might add, I'm not in favor of private accounts. I'm also not terribly against them either. There's all sorts of pros and cons. So we're not stepping back, or at least the proposals are not to step back from forced savings. It's just to do something different with them. Rather than sending them to the Treasury, where they're going to be part, in essence, of our government revenue, they're going to be sent partially into these so-called private accounts, which will force the government to do more borrowing to pay for all of the things that the government was normally paying for, including the existing Social Security system and the existing payouts. So the notion that we're going to leave people with no savings in retirement because they may not save isn't true. However, the notion that people might end up in retirement with relatively little wealth because the stock market crashed, that is a real risk. Moreover, the Social Security system more generally doesn't have enough resources to pay all of the promises that it's made. So we're going to have to either raise taxes or save more or cut benefits. One of those three things has to happen, and privatization doesn't change that equation.
And L.K. Weber, I want to put it to you. You study human behavior. What's your thought about our tolerance for risk? I mean, that it is a real possibility that just as you're getting ready to retire, your savings could get wiped out.
That is true. I think many of these decisions are a balance between hope and fear. If I just could maybe comment on the earlier caller. Obviously, there's obviously hope that personal investment decisions are going to make us better off in our old age. A lot of it is actually based on the fact that we might be overconfident in our ability to make our own investment decisions. I think the second caller was sort of responding more to the fear of being inadequately provided for in your old age, partly because your own inability to invest accurately, but also more likely because of the chance events that you allude to. There's absolutely no guarantee that the future economies are going to perform like current economists do. And you know, if more chance elements are part of our investment returns, we have to take more chances.
David, you are nodding at that notion about most of us think that we can do this better than we actually can. So what's the answer? I mean, many of us might not want to spend hours and hours and hours and hours getting educated as to the best way to get a return for our money.
What I would propose, if I were in the command seat, would is that there would be a default fund as part of a privatized system. And the default fund would be very carefully selected by very sensible people, and it would have very, very low management fees, maybe 16 basis points, which means 16/100ths of 1%, which is what the default fund in the Swedish privatized system charges. And that fund would be diversified, and that fund would be an easy option for anyone without financial sophistication to choose. So if we go down the route of privatized accounts, again, a route that I'm not advocating, we better have a default fund to enable people without financial sophistication to take the easy road.
I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, as you know, in politics, Social Security has traditionally been the third rail. Is there anything about this argument that's going to make it less incendiary than it has been every time politicians have been wrestling with this for the past 30 years and more?
Well, usually it's about pain. Usually that's what the Social Security problem is about. Taxes are going to go up, as they did in the 80s.
Or the warning that we're going to run out of money really soon.
Right. It's about our benefits will be cut or the age. It's all about – usually it's about pain, the Social Security. And it is still because we do have this shortfall, although some people think it's as far out as 2052. Nevertheless, so it's real pain. But now where he's put a new item in here. This item of ownership and of diverting your funds, this makes it seem like it's, you know, suddenly we can talk about Social Security because we've got this new thing in here that makes it different. It isn't pain. This is gain. And so I think this gives the president a certain leeway. The trouble is, logically, the two things, as the professor just said, do not come together. The crisis in the shortfall in the system, having demographic roots, and the privatization. The one is not a cure for the other. In fact, there's a lot of evidence starting to come out that privatization makes the fund of Social Security much worse off than it would be otherwise. So the president's talking about this pleasant thing when really the problem is the other matter of cutting raising the retirement age, cutting benefits, or raising taxes.
To New York City now, Pierre is on the line. Hi, Pierre. Welcome.
Good evening. I think we have somewhat of a wrong frame here, just like the other caller said. We already are an ownership society. We have a 401ks. We can invest however we like, SEP IRAs and all the rest. Social Security is an insurance. It is not a retirement program. It is part of it. Retirement is part of it, but it is an insurance for everybody regardless of whoever is. If any one of us gets injured in some way, we will get disability. It is an insurance. It has nothing to do with this gimmick of investing your money. We can do that at any time. Also, Social Security is not a tax. Some politicians call it a tax. Some people think it's a tax. It's not a tax. It's a tax, really, that comes back to you. So, therefore, it's not a tax. It's not like something that goes, some money that goes, and it, you know, from New York City, it goes to Georgia to build their roads.
Okay, we have it, Pierre. Thanks so much for the call. And, David, what would you say to Pierre about that?
Well, it has insurance components. That's certainly the case. But it's also a system that takes dollars from you when you're young and transfers dollars to you predictably when you're old. So it also has a savings component. It's not just insurance. It doesn't just pay out to people who have had bad knocks in life. But certainly insurance is an important component. Also, I would say it is a tax in some ways because you don't get back dollar for dollar what you put in. And in particular, it's an important system for transferring resources from some people to other people. So there are transfers built into the system, and in that sense, it is partially a tax as well. So it's all of these things. And trying to call it just one, I think, is misleading.
Much more to talk about on this topic. We're going to continue in just a moment. We're discussing this hour the ownership society and the sometimes irrational economic decisions we make. Do you let emotions trump reason when it comes to making tough decisions? Are you ready to spend hours poring over financial prospectuses? Or would you rather see a numbers cruncher in Washington in charge of your retirement? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about President Bush's campaign to give you more control over your future, and also about how people respond to more choices. Is an ownership society something we should be striving for? Will you be able to make clear-headed decisions when it comes to your retirement savings? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with David Labson, professor of economics at Harvard University, who's written extensively about saving for retirement, and with L.K. Weber, professor of psychology and management at Columbia University. She is co-editor of Risk, Decision, and Policy. And our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. David, I want to turn to you and ask whether there is something we might learn by watching how other countries have been grappling with some of these issues. Is there a model somewhere that might be instructive? Is there an experience that will give us some insight as to how people really behave when they have to make their own retirement decisions?
So there are three models that most people point to. The Chilean experience, the British experience, and now recently the Swedish experience. And sadly, two of those experiences are probably models of what we shouldn't be doing. In the Chilean example, privatization led to very, very high management fees. So a lot of the money that was put into the Chilean system was taken back in terms of the fees that were charged by the companies that managed those monies. Now, part of that was the marketing. Basically, these companies went out there and did a lot of marketing, spent a lot of cash to do advertising, pulled in the money from their investors, and then, of course, used those investors' monies to pay for the advertising that had just been used to attract the funds. That system is viewed as having not worked all that well, though it does have some successes. The British system also had some troubling investment patterns. A lot of the funds that went into the British private system were considered to be misinvested, that got involved in shady investments, shall we say. The Swedish system, I think, has been more successful. In that system, there's been a default fund. There's been a pretty active government oversight of the investment options. And after the initial wave of investments, now investors that are entering the Swedish system are almost all using the default fund. About 90% of the dollars flowing into the Swedish system today, or new investors, rather, are choosing the default fund. So I think we might look to the Swedish privatization system for an example of a regulatory structure that has worked. That said, the Swedish system gives people lots and lots of options, 500, actually, at latest count, 600 options. I wouldn't advise that for our system, but I think we can learn something from the Swedes.
L.K. Weber, we were talking earlier about some of the ways in which the government might still provide fewer choices, help save us from ourselves, as it were. From your experience and in studying human behavior, would people be grateful or resentful, do you think, of that kind of big brotherism?
I think it depends a little bit on the choice set, but I think by and large, the more options you have, the larger is the possibility for regret after the fact, which actually gets to a point that Aaron Bernstein made earlier, that it sort of depends on where you shift the focus of attention. So if you think about sort of the positive consequences, most people would think that more choices are better. If you think about the possibility for regret, having made a choice, and we know that's actually true for consumer purchases, people are less satisfied with their purchases if the choice was made from a larger set from a smaller set, in part because they can sort of after the fact think about what else they could have gotten instead. So I think, to use Dave's phrase, it depends.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York now and hear from John. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my point is that this concept that's being rolled out to make these private accounts or ownership accounts for each individual is going to have to make an analysis and a rather informed decision that's important to their lifestyle, the quality of their life, and what they pass along. And most people don't have sophisticated backgrounds, financial education, and on and on. And yet the guy that's proposing this idea, you know, by his own admission, up to age 40 or so, made a lot of bad decisions. And he came from a rather privileged background. He went to the best schools, Yale and Harvard, and on and on. He had a family safety net to fall behind. So given the resources he had and the fertile family and ground that he grew up in, how does one expect the average person to cut through all the smoke and all the options and understand all these financial choices in front of us and the true ramifications, you know, as they play out over 10, 20, 30 years? And I find that to be a little disingenuous, one. And secondly, it seems to be symptomatic and typical of so many of the programs that he puts forward.
John, thanks so much. It's an interesting point. I want to ask LK from the sort of human behavior standpoint and then David from an economic point of view that question. You know, how can the average person figure this out when most of us don't have good sense until we're pretty far along in life?
Well, I think most people won't figure it out. I mean, most people don't want to figure it out. I think also we should consider that, you know, these decisions are going to be most important really for people who are lower in socioeconomic status, who are lower in education, and you probably don't have the resources and the knowledge to make these decisions wisely. And yet for them, the consequences of the decisions really matter most. This is why it's really important to have defaults, you know, for people who do not want to or who cannot make these types of decisions.
So is there an economics piece as well, David, or are we really talking about human behavior, how people actually view these things, how we actually make our decisions?
Well, you might want to give them some choice. So at one extreme, 600 funds with no default, that would be a disaster, particularly if there were no regulation as to the nature of those funds. They could have enormous management fees, for example. At the other extreme, you could have one fund, which would basically be a system that had no choice. Probably something intermediate, but closer to the one fund system. Maybe three funds, maybe three diversified funds, or a very small number of diversified funds, well-managed, low fees. That would be a reasonable suggestion. And I would add to that, of course, a default fund as well, so that people who wanted to do no thinking could rely on the best and brightest minds to have made a choice for them.
This is, of course, being pitched very strongly to young people. Want to go to Somerville, Massachusetts. Chris is on the line. Chris, it sounds like you may fit that category.
Yes, absolutely. I have my current employer has a very good 403B program. They actually put in $2 to my one, up to 5%. So in that sense, I'm very fortunate and probably kind of unusual circumstance, but I don't think I'm terribly unusual with the idea that I've pretty much been raised with the notion that Social Security is not going to be there for me. So I've kind of been ingrained that, you know, I got to invest for myself, and you know, I have to admit that this private account suggestion is, you know, it's really targeted for young investors like myself, and it does sound pretty tempting.
How much time do you think it would take you, Chris, to do the homework that you feel that you would need to make wise choices?
Well, you know, right now I invest in index funds, and I mean that doesn't take hardly much time at all. I'm not the savviest investor. But I know enough that I put it in an index fund, it's going to track the market. And I know that over time, you know, you look back in the history of the stock market, it's gone up. Sure, there are short-term dips. But for me, you know, I'm 34. By the time I retire, any dips will be kind of smoothed out. And I would hope that by the time I actually get to retirement, I could put it in a safe place like bonds or money market.
All right, Chris. Well, we wish you well as you're planning for your retirement. Thanks so much for being with us.
And can I hire Chris to be my financial advisor?
I want to know where he's getting that $2 for $1 match, Jack.
Well, you know, Chris said it's not going to be there for me. The actuaries say that it is solvent until 2042, and the CBO makes that 2050 something. It will be there for you, Chris. There's no question about it. unless the government itself goes, you know, says we won't pay any of our bills, well, that would be a catastrophe, wouldn't it? It's going to be there for you, Chris. And this is part of, I think, in some ways, a kind of insidious undermining of faith in this program. If the actuaries say, no, Chris, when you retire, and you're going to retire before 2042, it's there for you.
Well, it won't be all there for you. 75% is what can be paid out
after 2042.
But
up to 2042, it's without any fixes, it's fine.
Of course, a lot of those pieces of paper are just assets we've written to ourselves. They're checks we've written to ourselves in the form of you borrow from the Treasury, you put it in the Social Security Trust Fund. So the pieces of paper that take us from 2018 to 2042 are just checks we've written to ourselves. That said, I agree with Jack. Social Security is not going away. It's going to be there, but it's probably not going to be there 100%.
Well, and that leads to the ultimate bottom line here, I guess, is how do we make sure that we don't wind up right back where we started 70 years ago? David.
Basically, we need to save more. It's as simple as that. And there's lots of ways to save more. You can save more in the household level, or you can dissave less at the government level, and that means cutting our federal deficit. So either way, it needs to happen. But if we want to have resources available when we are disproportionately more retirees and less workers 30 years from now, we're going to have to put that money away now. So it's pretty simple. Someone's got to do the saving. The government has to do the saving for us, or we've got to do the saving for ourselves.
Okay, Weber, you get the last word here. How do we make sure that we don't get ourselves right back in the same fix we were 70 years ago?
Well, I completely agree with David. I think we have to sort of get away from this notion that we are a consumer society to the notion that we are a society who needs to take care of our future, whether it's our own future or whether it's our collective future. And there's so many institutions in place, you know, that sort of tempt us to consume now, to spend our money now. There's very little in place that reminds us every day of future consequences and of the need for more precautionary behavior.
So, Jack Beatty, perhaps we need to be reminded more often tomorrow does come.
What did Scarlett O'Hara say? Tomorrow is another day. And, you know, you ask about 70 years ago. 70 years ago, old age meant penury. It meant poverty. Today, the rate among the elderly is about 10 or 12%. It should be lower, but that is an immense human achievement owing to Social Security.
Jack Beatty, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
David Labson, thank you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
David is professor of economics at Harvard University, and L.K. Weber, who joined us from New York, professor of psychology and management at Columbia University. L.K., thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on Forums. This is On Point. Harvard University President Larry Summers has come under fire over his recent remarks suggesting biological differences might help explain why fewer women ascend to top academic jobs in science. In a meeting with the university's faculty yesterday, Summers was conciliatory. Some faculty said they hoped the meeting would bring about better relations. Others are less willing to forgive their president for remarks they call divisive. Harvard senior Sarah Seltzer says her university's president is off the mark. In this radio diary, she looks back at her academic career and says deeper cultural mores are to blame.
When I was in ninth grade, geometry was my favorite subject. I was bored in English and history, but Mr. Refkin inspired me. I was proving theorems like Pythagoras himself, I thought. I was fascinated by the visualization of shapes. It clicked. I loved math. But this bravado didn't last. I spent the next 3 years struggling with math demons. A's were followed by C's in quick succession. A few topics in calculus and pre-calc piqued my interest. And once I even spent a history class trying to solve a math problem with glee. But usually it was the other way around. Math class was absorbed by writing sonnets, and I left without having understood the material. My twin brother remained in honors math with ease, but he was beginning to lose faith in our AP English class. He was disappointed with the grade he received on a creative project, and the vast majority of his classmates were an in-crowd of theory-spouting women. He didn't really like them. Although he'd been an A English student, he turned his attention elsewhere. In the past couple of weeks, Harvard President Lawrence Summers has ushered the issue of gender and subject matter into the spotlight. In response, I've gone back to high school memories to wonder why there were always so few girls in AP Physics, or in the school student government. When I was a junior, a bunch of us staged a day-long walkout and rally to bemoan gender inequality in school. During the rally, we posted ratios around the hallways, such as ratio of males to females who have been student body president, 16 to 1, and ratio of men to women in AP English, 1 to 4. Men in particular were incensed. "It's not our fault that women can't get elected," they'd say, or "it's not our fault that women can't do physics." But that wasn't our point. The point was to ask ourselves why males and females were still making such divergent choices, why talented girls were constantly crying over bad math tests in the hallways, and guys swore that they just didn't get poetry. My theory is that my failure in math was due to a preemptive fear of failure. My guess is that many young women are similarly uncomfortable with the aggressive risk-taking associated with math and the physical sciences, and are afraid to fill in that blank space with the wrong answer. For American girls, the value of keeping up an appearance of perfection is often ingrained very early. In my math class, the boys shrugged off bad grades and vowed to study harder. But for me, a C penetrated into my very soul, affecting my self-confidence. My parents had encouraged me to do math, but somewhere along the line, I absorbed society's expectations and internalized them. Every test became a, will I fail? And therefore meant so much more than it should have. Many of my friends rode the same emotional roller coaster when it came to math, even those who were science-oriented. As for poetry, a form invented by men, changing mores have chased guys away from the humanities. In high school, talking about books means talking about feelings, you know, love, despair, and loneliness, not to mention race and gender. That's so wussy, or whatever word is currently a substitute for non-masculine. So guys develop a distaste for literature. And it didn't stop in high school. My English seminars remain ridiculously full of estrogen, to the detriment of everyone's understanding of literature. If we all look into our pasts, we can watch ourselves get socialized into gendered ways of thinking. We either embrace the norm or defy it. But what if there was no norm? What if all girls could be sure that they could get physics, and guys were sure that they could get poetry? Would we line up in equal numbers to pursue every profession? Probably not. But as Larry Summers should have known, until that opportunity presents itself, innate differences are not even worth talking about.
Sarah Seltzer is a senior majoring in English at Harvard University. She hails from New York City. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.